In Court of Blades, you're playing very canny retainers. These are not your run-of-the-mill kind of like hired henchmen that you throw a bag of money to and go, oh, follow the girl. These are very much like prized, and all of the playbooks they play that up. You're not just somebody holding a rancier and guarding the gate. You are the Bravo. You are the champion of the house. You're the Hawk. You're a bounty hunter. You're, you know, the Knack. You are the sorcerer, the house sorcerer.
So what happens when two geeks that love role-playing run into each other and fall in love? Today's episode is with two designers who are actually partners. I got a chance to sit down with Navi and Sean Drake. Like me, they're huge fans of John Harper's Blades in the Dark. Unlike me, they have the talent and the drive to actually create their own Forged in the Dark game. When this episode drops, their Kickstarter for Court of Blades has only a handful of days left. We talk about where the idea of Court of Blades came from. We talk about how it compares to Blades in the Dark, what it shares and what makes it different. We talk about the rich world that they've created. And finally, we take the step-by-step process of going from concept to iteration to playtest to finalizing a game and then eventually putting it out on Kickstarter. If Renaissance court intrigue, backstabbing, retainers doing the dirty work of their houses sounds interesting to you, then sit back and enjoy my conversation with Navi and Sean Drake. Enjoy.
Third Floor Wars delivers interviews, insights, and discussions about everything hitting the tabletop. In a world where life hits you from all sides, you deserve time to relax, disconnect, and unplug. Rule books, plastic models, dice, and cards in hand. Let the gaming begin. Tabletop games let you escape and unleash grand battles and regale epic tales of adventure with your friends. If you love gaming and learning from players, designers, experts, and creators, you are in the right place. Pull up a chair. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Podcast.
Howdy friends, Craig here. Now, some of you may not be aware of it, and it was something that was relatively new to me, and it's this concept of a hack. So I learned about it as I came back to role playing, and it's very, very interesting. And it's an idea of taking, and this has been around forever, just wasn't really named anything. It was the idea of taking a system and taking parts of that system and putting new aspects on it so it ultimately becomes another game. And one game that has several hacks, in fact, there's a term for it called Forged in the Dark, is John Harper's Blades in the Dark, which everybody knows I'm a huge fan of. So I keep my eyes on the different Forged in the Dark games that are out there. And this is the first time that I've ever had somebody who's made a Forged in the Dark game on the show. And that's because I backed their Kickstarter and I'm super excited to learn about this game. So today with us, we've got Sean and Navi Drake. So Navi, welcome to the Third Floor.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
So you guys are officially the second couple or partners that I've ever had on the show. The first were McGay and Vincent Baker. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked them, because normally you get the, how did you find gaming question from me. But I guess the first question is, did the Drakes find each other, then find gaming, or did the Drakes find gaming independently, then found each other, or was one? How did this play out? So take me through the timeline, Navi.
We've been together a long time, but not that long. So I started gaming when I was about, I want to say 12, maybe a little bit younger, because, you know, Nintendo had already come out when I was a kid. So at 6, I'm playing Mario. But my first RPG, I was 12, because that's when Zelda came out, right?
So nice.
I've been gaming for a while. But we got together also because of a shared love of storytelling. We met in one of those kind of play-by-post things.
Very cool.
Yeah, so gaming is actually a big part of our history, not just individually, but together.
So, Sean, welcome to the Third Floor. So that means that you were gaming before you met Navi as well?
Oh, yeah.
12 years old? Or did she beat you?
Lord. let's see. Let me carbon date myself. That was about 25 years ago that I got invited into a kind of a smoky rec room on Lodge's Air Force Base, and there were like these wizards kind of behind the table, and they're like, I mean, I was there with my best friend in, you know, fifth grade, and he's like, hey, my dad and his buddies, they run this game, and it was Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, how cool.
First edition Dungeons and Dragons. And yeah, from there it was just finding any kind of game I could kind of sink my teeth into. And yeah, I'm at the love of my life in a play-by-post forum. So
I have never done play-by-post. So, I mean, I understand the concept of it. You have somebody who, quote unquote, runs the game. And then instead of sitting around a table, you just communicate, not live with voice, but just kind of say, this is what my character is going to do. This is what you kind of see.
Yeah, just like you would, especially with these narrative games like the Forge in the Dark games and Blades in the Dark, it's even more in that vein of everything is explained. What are you doing? You're really acting in character. So it was like that before big narrative games really had come out. So you explain everything in detail, and then there's still some dice rolls to keep things random. But it was nice because you could like get that little text out real quick in between your classes or something.
Got
so you didn't have to dedicate a huge chunk of time. So you could just play on and off for, you know, ever.
Most of the ones that we were playing in didn't even have like a facilitator or anything. It was purely collaborative fiction.
No kidding, really? Yeah. So without someone actually running the game?
Yeah, everybody was responsible for bringing their own plots.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. All right. So now I need to figure this out, because this is the question my wife and I get all the time. And it's a contentious question. And that is, did Sean go, I want to play just more than play by post with Navi? So, or did Navi go, I kind of want to do more than just play by post? Or did you guys figure it out together at once? Where you're like, this might be more than just I'm going to play an elf and he's going to play a wizard.
Are we that transparent? Like, you know, I was interested in her from pretty much the word go, but I always just thought that she was just a random voice on the internet or a bunch of text on a screen. And she had already like found me and like knew everything about me. And
I was reading your mail.
Exactly. Yeah. She was basically like looking into my, through my bedroom window.
Oh, that's funny. So yeah, my elf is gonna go into the dungeon. Yeah, but don't wear that sweater. You look terrible in that sweater. What the hell? That's phenomenal. Oh, that's great.
These are the things that true love is made of right here.
I agree. So the two of you become the Drakes, and I assume gaming continues through the courting and the merger.
Yeah, when I first moved in with him, it was funny. I had already played Dungeons & Dragons previously, but I don't think that he was aware. So when I show up on his doorstep, he's like, so I do this kind of weird thing where on Saturday nights I get together with my friends. And for a moment there, I'm like, oh, it's, you know, beer and pretzels and poker. I can play poker. But then he's like, so we played Dungeons & Dragons. I was like, okay, I'm in. I'm making a character right now.
I got a druid. I can do this.
Oh, that's great. So the first date was playing D&D.
Yeah, kind of. Like, I mean,
that's amazing. That's amazing. You guys were destined to be where you are right now.
The stars all aligned.
So when did just being a player or being a GM, when was that not enough? When did either of you or together you start dabbling and saying, you know what, let's change this, let's change that? When did the design become part of your play?
Yeah, I've always been a GM. I'm one of those people who is just very comfortable behind the screen. My fourth ever Dungeons & Dragons game, like the old wizard who ran our game was sick. And I'm like, I could probably run something. And they're like, you're 11. Okay, well, let's see what you got. And very, very shortly after there, I had gotten through all the books that were available on this tiny little island we were living on. And I had to come up with new stuff. So I've been designing, you know, in the small kind of homebrewy ways that everybody who takes a seat behind the screen does.
Sure.
Pretty much from the word go. But I never thought that it would be something big and then that I could show people and not be embarrassed about.
Right. Well, I guess that's my question then is, you know, because yes, you know, players are designers, right? As are GMs, right? So we've all done that. But I don't have a Kickstarter. I have not put a game out there that is consistently retweeted by John Harper. So at what point did it become like, I think somebody else might like what I see. And was that Court of Blades or was it something else?
I guess it was probably when we realized that what we were doing, like we were noodling on this game because we had somebody who was excited to play this type of game. And the moment that it became more than just, okay, we're playing Blades in the Dark, but in this kind of more romantic and Renaissance setting, when we realized that there was a lot of real cool narrative juice and a lot of interesting innovations that kind of came along with the system, we're like,
yeah,
I think this is something else.
That's cool.
It didn't take very long before it went from a hack to realizing that it was no longer a hack, because we had stripped out so much and replaced so much and then built so many new mechanics to support the story that if you picked it up as a hack just by itself, you'd have a very hard time getting it to correspond with the original game. So after that point, it was took on a life of its own.
It's really neat when I see that happening, and I see it being done at different degrees. So you see sometimes where, you know, because, I mean, you could argue that Blades in the Dark is a hack of Powered by the Apocalypse World, right? But it's so different, right? His journey was so long that even the dice don't work the same way, but the heart of it's still there. And I've seen, and I'm not going to, we won't get into it, but I've seen some Forged in the Dark games where I was like, okay, you've done a little too much for me, right? I like what I love is not there, and what you've added, I don't really care about. And, you know, and it's nothing that they're doing wrong, right? The whole idea is to make it your own. That was not the case with you guys. So what we're going to do is I'm going to take a quick break because I'm dying to hear how you navigated that and how this evolved. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Keep in mind, the Insider Insight series is my opportunity to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and methods for crafting their creation. So we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to find where this Court of Blades began. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats, save yourself some money, and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code. So let's pretend that I've gone to university and I'm taking History of the Drakes, and I need to, you know, pull out the book and find out, you know, when Court of Blades first began. So if we were to forensically go back and look for the seeds, the little tiny nuggets where I could go, yes, that's where it started. That's where it began. Where would I look?
So it was almost 2 years ago now. We had a...
Oh, wow.
We had a girlfriend who's loved to play tabletop games, but her girlfriend didn't like to play tabletop games, and there was just nothing that appealed to her. So she had said, you know, I want a game that's, you know, filled with romance and reminds me of those kind of like political intrigues. And there aren't a whole lot of games like that. We just kind of had a moment where we're like, you know, we could probably make something work. So that's really where it started to take shape, was really just from a friend requesting something, going, I want this thing that doesn't exist.
And did you guys know this was going, like, what's the first play of this look like then? Do you say, you know what, we love Blades, let's try with Blades? Or okay, so it started with Blades.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been my favorite game since we picked it up. I had played Dungeons and Dragons for many years. And as soon as he first pitched Blades, and it was my first experience with a game outside of Dungeons and Dragons, I'm like, wow. I'm not gonna like this. This isn't gonna be, this is not my style. And then, session one, and I'm like, this is the best thing that's ever been made ever. and since then, I've played, we've played a lot of games together, so we're constantly picking up new systems. And Blades continues to be my favorite game of all time.
So why is that, Navi? What is it that I mean, especially for it to be almost your second game outside of D&D, what was it that made it set its hooks?
It's the strong narrative and the shared story amongst everyone. So you don't feel like the GM is just kind of taking you on a sightseeing tour. You actually get to shape the story, which brought me back to my roots of that shared storytelling through text. So it brought me back that way. And then the mechanics of, Brisky, Desperate Standard, like your position, and the things that kind of spin out from that, it feels much more organic. And when you fail a role in this system, it still pushes the story forward and it still feels good. And that's really kind of unique and special, because a lot of times when you fail a role in a game, it's like, well, I guess I'm waiting another hour for my turn.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Now, I would be curious, Sean, were you the same way? Were you just like, yeah, this is phenomenal? Or
so one of the things about, I had a breadth of system knowledge before I ever picked up Blades in the Dark.
Oh,
but
wow.
When
okay.
I picked up Blades in the Dark, I immediately keyed in on position and effect. It's my favorite mechanic of probably any game I've ever played, just because it's a negotiation. There are tools to affect the narrative in that. Really what it comes down to is every time I run a new system for Navi, she's like, it's good, but I wish we could have that conversation before the dice hit the table. It took a second for me to grok, to really kind of get into the weeds and like figure out what these dials meant.
Yep.
But now that I have a little bit of system mastery with it, I can't go back.
Yeah, it's interesting. For those listening that aren't familiar with Blades in the Dark, what we're talking about is something that I think is unique. I think the first time I've seen it put together the way that Mr. Harper did is a position and effect. So if I'm playing with the Drakes and we decide, something's happening, and I say, all right, Navi, we're going to need a roll for that to happen. So Navi says that she's going to pull her knife and she's going to stab the guy. One of the things that I say to Navi is I say, well, your position is either really strong or really weak, right? So either she's in a really good place or a real desperate place. And then I explain that her effect, which is if she's successful, how successful will she be at this? That'll be either a great effect or limited effect. And what's neat about it is Navi goes, oh, okay, well, what if I were to do this instead? Right? And I go, well, that would change this, that would change that. And that's the conversation that we're talking about. And I got to be honest, I don't know if this was true for the two of you. That was the thing I skimmed over, right? When I was first grokking the game and playing the first couple things, I was like, okay, that's kind of neat. It's kind of interesting. But to your point, Sean, and where your love of it comes from, Navi, is like, it becomes the biggest part of the game, I think, once you kind of get your arms around it.
Yeah, it's fundamental. Fundamental.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. All right, so we decide we want to get our friend's girlfriend. We want to play a game that she likes. So the tone of Duskfall and Blades in the Dark is not quite what she's looking for. So what is the first time she sits down? What does she play?
So what she pitched to us was actually really funny. She wanted a game that was in the same tone as a side quest from Dragon's Age Inquisition, where you go to Orlane and you're at the masked ball and you don't know who your friends are, you don't know, what you can say, who you can be free around, just suspicion, and you never know who's who. And she wanted that to be the game.
Yeah. Sign me up.
Yeah, right? I'm looking at this game and I'm thinking, okay, Blades in the Dark isn't quite there. What if instead of hardscrabble scoundrels, we're noble courtiers, and we're just at these strange kind of subterfuge laden events,
right?
And we got to the table and it felt okay, but it was missing a little bit of that kind of juice, right?
Right.
wasn't Like, I'm pretty sure we had like 6 actions, and most of them were just different ways to sway. There was a lot of lying going on.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure we had like lie, prevaricate, like we circumlocute, like.
Really, really lie.
Yeah, exactly. Lie by omission. That's a different thing.
That's fun.
So we eventually kind of nailed it down to we can't be the nobles here because they have too much to lose. We can't get into hijinks without everything kind of falling apart. So we're like, what if we were, like, to put it in kind of a Game of Thrones parlance, what if we weren't Jaime Lannister or Tyrion or anything like that? What if we were more like Bronn? What if we were the agents that were affecting these kind of broad and sweeping things? We were given this latitude, and that's where we started drilling down, and we hit something pretty magic.
So that's interesting that you say that, because I don't think it registered, because it was one of the first questions I thought of, because as I was reading, you know, starting to digest the game as I was coming, I came across first, I think it was Twitter that turned me on to it at first. I fully went into it expecting to play, what's the movie with John Malkovich? Dangerous Liaisons.
Oh, yeah.
And so I expected to play those characters, right? The Michelle Pfeiffer and, you know, so on and so forth. And I was like, oh, no, you don't. You play a couple rungs down. And that's interesting that it was a function of you have too much to lose, so it limits play. Does that sound accurate?
It would definitely change the scope of play, because you're much less likely to be doing something covert and dangerous yourself if you're the whole family. Can you imagine a whole noble family sneaking out to commit an assassination or something that's politically necessary?
So, Navi, when you went through the first iteration of this and played it as the nobles, were you in agreement with Sean that you were just like, yeah, this doesn't quite fit? And did you identify the same thing?
We are usually on the same page. I think I might actually be the pickier one of the two of us, because when it comes to like things being wrong, I'm the first one to just go, no, not that. this is bad, and we need to fix this. So that's me. And I'm removing mechanics that I feel like are not lending themselves to the game correctly. I'm like, just take the whole mechanic out. And sometimes he gets a little frustrated with that.
We have a graveyard of cool mechanics that I was really like, I'm the mechanics goblin. Like, I collect bits and pieces and cast-offs and detritus from everything that I have ever played. And anytime something looks cool, I go back to my toolbox and I'm like, ooh, I found this thing. And we can put that in there. And she's like, that's stupid. Why are we doing this?
But how powerful is it for the two of you to have that, right? So, like, I'm imagining it like you're like two concentric circles, right? Where there's not a complete overlap. So you're both are able to bring something to the conversation, but there's a shared, it sounds like there's a shared like outcome, right? Like I get the sense you both knew what this was going to look like at the end, but you were coming at it and pulling and pushing the whole way. Does that sound right?
That's incredibly accurate.
Yeah, that's about as spot on as it gets.
That's cool. So you then decide, okay, we're not going to play the nobles. We're going to take a couple runs down. Let's move forward a couple more iterations. So we're now halfway into development a little bit, and I'd like to get a sense of when things started to click. When you started going, okay, wait a second, we're not changing it every week now. We're starting to find our groove. When do you feel like that happened, and what happened before that?
Those were fun days. where we show up to our weekly game. God, they were patient. We redid all your load. All of your stress abilities are completely, but I like that one. Well, you know. Sorry.
I could not do this. I would be like, you guys can go fuck yourself. Yeah. I'm not playing your game anymore.
This is why they get thanks, like right up in the
exactly.
Very beginning of the book.
Front page.
Let's play Fiasco. Screw this.
Exactly. It's just masochists all the way down.
Great that you have them, though.
Yeah. We hit the jackpot with these guys. The moment that it really started to click was when we realized that we had this big open city. We've got all of these intrigues and things going on, but the moment we really took a look at how to apply pressure, because that's one of the great things that Blades in the Dark does.
Yep.
Everything is just a huge pressure cooker, and you'll never have enough coin, and somebody's always mad at you. You never have enough downtime actions, so you're just basically like riding these characters until the wheels fall off. As soon as we establish the social season, you've only got 3 errands that you can go on every social season before the advancement of all of the other plots in the city go on. Having to make those choices We can go foil the assassination, but we may not be able to negotiate peace between these two factions over here. This person is calling for aid, but we don't have time. Do we hunt the monster that's, you know, walking through the arbor every midnight and snacking on farmers? Or do we go and, you know, attend this masquerade that we're expected at? So that layer of pressure, as soon as we got that social season, as soon as we started getting the social season mechanic nailed down and the GM's turn, that was when it started being Court of Blades.
Very, very cool. And I'm going to get into in the next segment where I want to really get into a lot of the really crunchy stuff here. Because like I said, this was the first time I've wanted to have a Forged in the Dark on the show, because it was the first time I was like, every change, I was like, Oh, I like this. This is interesting. This is interesting. So I want to grok that. But now I've got to do a weird game with you real quick before we take our break. I want to imagine you're both in isolation booths, right? So this is going to be like a weird dating game, matching, whatever it is. So the first person who's got headphones that can't hear the question, even though she will, is Navi. So I want to ask you, Sean, now that the game is done, right? It's as we are talking right now, it is on Kickstarter. If you had to pick the biggest contribution that Navi brought, so if I were to open, when I get my copy of Court of Blades, where am I going to see the biggest Navi fingerprint?
World building. It's got to be world building. She writes an awful lot of like the kind of spitballed ideas that really make Ilrian sing.
That's cool.
The you know, factions and things like that. All the NPC names, like all of their descriptors, that's all Navi.
Very, very nice. All right, so Navi, where am I going to see the biggest Sean fingerprint?
Oh my goodness, he is my mechanics goblin. If I need mechanics, I go to him and I tell him what I'm trying to make happen. This is what I want to happen, and he looks at it and goes, okay, I can figure this out. And then he usually comes up with some really good mechanics for us to try and work out. And it's really the best kind of match you can imagine. I just basically go, make this happen, and he does.
Tell me why it works this way. Okay.
Well, what's cool about that too though, is that you're also the taste tester afterwards, right? So you also, it sounds like, have a sense for, I'm going to give this problem to Sean. Sean is going to bring me a solution, and I understand things well enough and have a sense of things from what I'm hearing that you can go, yeah, you're going to have to go back because this sucks. Or holy shit, you did it. This is great. So that's very, very cool. And then for Sean to have somebody who can help put what is often neglected and not talked about and often to be the critical piece of it is what wraps around it. Because let's be honest, when we go through and talk about our favorite games, we don't talk about, you know, you throw 6-sided dice and 20-sided dice. We spend the first 20 minutes boring the shit out of people, telling them about what the world is like. So that's cool. So guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk about where we still see Blades in the Dark in the game, and where we see something that's truly unique. We'll be right back.
Hi, I am Eli, and I'm the spirit animal of the USFT, and the person who claimed me was Craig Shipman.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth $1 a month, $5 a month, $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go buy our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week.
Hey, it's time to welcome some of the newest floorheads to our Patreon. Big thanks goes out to Joe Root, Alan Cardinal, Raven Zatto, Richard Beach, Philip Savoy, Patrick Allen, Third, Sean P. Kelly, Jesse Ravicki, James Kahn, Rage Quit Wire, Doc Royal, Aloy Centron, Robo Rotten, and Jacob Suderman. Because of you and the 100 plus other patrons, we're able to put out content on a weekly basis. Thank you.
All right, so and unfortunately, this might end up being more of a Sean segment, and then we'll go to the Navia segment after this. So don't think I'm ignoring you, Navia, in this conversation, and don't be afraid to dominate the conversation, Sean, if need be. But let's start maybe with the easiest thing, which is if someone picks up the quarter blades cold and flips through it, and how will they immediately know it's a Forged in the Dark game outside of the label? When will they go, oh yeah, this is a type, what's in common with blades?
Sure. So it was important for us to keep it accessible. Keeping all the things that we love about Blades in the Dark, all the things that keep us coming back to Blades in the Dark.
Right.
So action rolls, resistance, flashbacks, declaring, you know, load and gear in retrospect, like, oh yeah, no, I totally brought that with me. Big focus on factions. The stress economy is still there, slightly modified. Mm. But yeah, it's going to have a lot that's familiar to anybody who's played a Forged in the Dark game. But it's kind of the things that differentiate us are sort of folded into that and kind of plugged into those wheels and gears and levers that run, you know, our favorite game.
Yeah, and that's what I think I first noticed I didn't feel like things were pasted on. They were kind of layered in, if that makes any sense, which I thought was very, very interesting. So Navi, in your mind, what is probably the first thing where you think, you know, this is where it's not Blades, but it's distinctly Court.
I think that it's first in the tone. The tone really takes you out of anything that I know of anyways that Forged in the Dark games are currently doing, which is kind of a lighter, more emotional, you take scandals, so you're worried about your reputation, not necessarily being harmed physically. So I think that's one of the first thing that you're going to really feel the difference when you're looking through. Like, okay, so these mechanics look very familiar, but everything is shifted towards your reputation and emotions and things that are much more personal than necessarily catching scars.
Now you might still be.
You might still catch them.
So how do you find that being backed up mechanically, right? So I understand the feel that you're talking about and that atmosphere. Is that strictly narrative? Is that something that we just play? Or is there some mechanics that build that and support that in your mind?
There are a lot of mechanics. Some of them are like almost like reskins in a way. So you have your scandals, for instance, or there's no coin in the system. You're taken care of. There's no need for money. You're not hard scrabbling. So you're going to be collecting favor and acclaim.
Oh,
and
nice.
You're trying to build a reputation. And so when you go to negotiate with someone, it's not how much can I pay you, it's how much is my name worth right now, especially up against whoever you're going up against. So
right.
That's where I think mechanically it starts to get kind of interesting.
Yeah, our retainers don't acquire acquire trauma in the course of their adventures. They acquire scandals.
So cool.
Instead of getting, you know, progressively more kind of hard-bitten and cynical, living down in the gutter, it's your social reputation that's like, you're known now in all the best circles as faithless or grasping or wicked.
Sentimental.
Oh yes, far too sentimental to live long in Ilrian.
Oh, that's phenomenal. So if I, let's say that I have a couple scandals, then how is that going to impact play? So we understand how traumas do. And in a lot of ways, traumas are more narrative than anything. And they're kind of like your road to death. How is that true? Or how does that how is it the same or different with scandals?
Oh, scandals are kind of fun because with your traumas, usually it's the onus is solely on you to sort of play up your traumas, and you get rewarded for that. And
yep.
you absolutely get to play up your scandals as well, but it's also something that the GM can play with, because the GM
right.
can, you know, this NPC, this powerful NPC, knows about this particular scandal, and it's going to become a big problem for your entire coterie for this errand. So it's more, you can interface with it from both directions.
Got it. So you mentioned load. How is load the same as how is load different?
Well, we took out a little bit of the granularity. Instead of having light, medium, and heavy load, we've only got two levels of load. We have discrete, where you are less than three pieces of kit, And then we've got, Loaded, where you are carrying six or more pieces of kit. But the difference is that even if you look like a operative out on a mission in Blades in the Dark with four pieces of gear, that's way more than you would expect anybody like at a fancy dinner party to be carrying.
Sure. And so it's, and this kind of gets into the flashback thing too. So, when I try to sell people to play Blades, so you just need to go buy it. I inevitably you talk about Ocean's 11. I say, you know how in Ocean's 11 that, you know, they always seem to have the right equipment with them and, you know, they're stuck. And then all of a sudden you see a flashback, and that's how I explain those mechanics. I'd be curious how that works in this world, right? So it seems when you're playing scoundrels and thieves and assassins, those mechanics make a ton of sense to me because of that framing. How does the framing work for Court, where those mechanics make sense?
In Court of Blades, you're playing very canny retainers. These are not your run-of-the-mill kind of like hired henchmen that you throw a bag of money to and go, oh, follow the girl. These are very much like prized, and all of the playbooks they play that up. You're not just somebody holding a rancier and guarding the gate. You are the Bravo. You are the champion of the house. You're the Hawk. You're a bounty hunter. You're, you know, the Knack. You are the sorcerer, the house sorcerer. And that's kind of how, in the same way that a very, you know, knowledgeable scoundrel would know exactly what they need, these retainers are very much in the same way. And that's taken through into the load. It's not just the gear that they're carrying, but amongst those, you have your special permissions, things that you can invoke in the midst of a scene. Like gear, you tick a box and you have a believable excuse. Or a small pricey gift. Or if you're the Knack, a vulgar display of power.
And that allows you to immediately, by taking that load, allows you to immediately take over for half a second and dictate what's happening in the world.
You have the controls at that point. A lot of people, they'll be in a desperate situation, but they're like, ooh, I have this vulgar display of power. What does that do? And then I'm like, well, you're the Knack. You tell me how you're getting out of this with that vulgar display of power.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Now, Navi, one of the things that you kind of hinted at is how much you enjoy, you know, the classic apocalypse, failing forward and, succeeding with consequences. How do consequences work in your game versus Blades?
So the consequences are similar. The way you receive consequences is very similar, but once again, it has that extra layer of the social on it. So a consequence normally, like if you're playing Blades, the consequences, you just got stabbed. So you take level 2 harm. You just stabbed. It's fine. But in Court, you may take level 2 harm. You've been embarrassed. You've been publicly humiliated by this rival, and that is still going to affect, you're going to lose dice when you go to roll for your social rolls because you're humiliated, you're trying to regain your footing. So you're going to take those kind of social harms. And we have social harms that function like fatal harm. If you are excommunicated, then that's the end of your character.
Yeah.
Dismissed from service.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So, I found the Drakes with this game and, started following them on Twitter and started getting super excited about the game, backed it immediately. But just recently was poking around and found that you guys have produced on your itch Blades in the Dark scores, which, don't take this the wrong way, I was super skeptical about. I'm like, I'm not going to buy a module for Blades in the Dark. And I think I paid like something stupid, like $12 total for both of them. They're stupid, ridiculous, cheap. There's pay what you want. So like for those listening, like it's like stupid value. How much you get here. Here's what's cool. They didn't do what I was hoping they didn't do, which is to completely say, you know, then this happened, then this and that. You guys did a wonderful job of keeping the flavor of the game and setting up frameworks and giving me a bunch of choices. So before we turn and talk about the world of Court, I do want to talk about this and know, where did this come from and when did you guys decide, hey, you know, let's put these out?
Yeah. This came as a direct result of joining the Hacked in the Dark community. It's a Blades in the Dark community Discord that we were active in. They were putting together a charity zine, just full of cool extra setting information, and I think we had like a cocktail menu in there. We had holidays and things like that. And they're like, could you maybe do like a score? Well, it kind of flies in the face of everything that Blades in the Dark is for. It's supposed to be one of these kind of, what are we doing tonight, guys? And how do we make that happen?
But we had seen Sean Nittner, because Sean Nittner had done a couple when Blades was a little bit younger that are very similar in style. Actually, the formatting is almost identical. I was basically like, thank you for the formatting. I don't have to worry about that now. Sean Nittner's fantastic. He did a couple. One was like a revolution, I
riot,
think. A riot, that's right. So that was really kind of a blueprint for making really cool scores.
And I ran the Dust Bowl Riots mm-hmm. a couple of times, just as little one shots to kind of palate cleanse or to introduce people to the game. And I'm like, we could do one of these. So we did one. We did Night at the Opera, which is
nice.
At the Arms of the Weeping Lady, the old broken down opera house, and we had a lot of fun with it. And I'm like, man, I want to do 50 of these. And then you know how Twitter is. If you say you're going to do 50 of them, then people start asking questions like, when's the next one coming out? So we've got 20 of them done right now. We're planning on doing 30 more.
That's phenomenal.
Five for each crew type.
Very, very cool. Yeah, they're great. So for those of you that play Blades, just go buy them. We're releasing this. This is going to be out on the 13th, which means that this evening in the future for us, I'll be doing a Blades in the Dark with the hosts of Gaming and BS, with Sean and Brett from Gaming and BS. And this is the first time they've played Blades, and it's very much a one shot, and it's being driven by the fact that neither of them have played the game before, and I keep telling them, like, guys, you're going to like this game. This is good. It also has to do with Brett as a scorned lover of John Harper, because he was one of the people that was mad about the Kickstarter. And when he got his book, he immediately sold it and was like, screw this, I don't want to play. And I'm like, Brett, I'm telling you, like, you're missing out here. So I finally talked those two idiots into coming on my live stream, and I'm going to run Blades. But I was trying to think, like, I don't want to run it like I do with people that are more experienced with it, right? So, and I was like, all right, you know, and then I saw this and I'm like, I'll grab this and see if I get some ideas. So we are going to be tonight in the future. Tonight we're going to be running, I think I'm going to do the Oof.
Fireborn.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they are assassins. So it's perfect. And I'm not quite sure how I'm going to frame it. I'm not quite sure where I'm going to put it yet. But I was like, oh, this is good. This is good. So for those of you that are dumb enough and listen to this when it first comes out, and it's still the 13th, make sure you watch it tonight. And you guys can see me massacre their good work.
There you go.
But the part that I'm really excited about is to talk about this world. So let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to learn where this world came from and what this world is. We'll be right back. Howdy, friends. Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com, that's with one M, or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code Third Floor Friend, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. So earlier we kind of understood where the beginnings of the game came from. And it sounds like the feel predated the world, which is not uncommon, right? But it also sounds like where things started to click is when the world became real. So Navi, when did the world start to form?
Oh my goodness. That is a question. I don't think I could point to a moment where I was like, yes, that's when. I remember that we, you know, I had the broad strokes. I'm like, all right, this is sort of what it looks like. And then I just sort of started filling in. When we first started playing, we didn't really even have factions. So like, right. I'd show up every week with, surprise, guys, I made you some factions. So it was a slow development, just kind of adding and layering things on once we knew how we wanted the world to kind of feel and function. Just knowing that we wanted to stay very romantic and Renaissance and a little bit swashbuckly, you know, like we wanted to capture that Three Musketeers feel. So that was just staying in that pocket the entire time is kind of how I handled it. But I really don't think I can point to a moment where Illyrian kind of became a living thing for me. There you go.
Go ahead. I can. I was planning on running a Thieves Guild Dungeons and Dragons game way back in the way back. And I pitched this setting that I was tinkering around on a novel with that was kind of inspired by Wheel of Time. There's a city where the Great Game of Houses is played, and I'm like, that would be a really cool place. And it's kind of inspired by Lies of Locke Lamora, as you know, turns out Blades in the Dark was. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be really cool. And it never happened, so I just kind of shelved it, and I had the book like half written, and I'm like, this is fine. And I remember Navi was asking, I need six vaguely Italian families. I'm like, I just happen to have six vaguely Italian family names.
You meant to have 12, but you're only halfway there, right? So luckily you had six.
Exactly. So I just polished those off and I'm like, hey, will that work? And she's like, this is perfect. And then she went and she, you know, skittered off to her writing corner and punched out lore and things for those, and we brought them to our table, and people were like, this is really cool, it's really well thought out. I'm like, really?
No one's gonna, I didn't want to finish my crappy book, so I'm glad this worked. That's phenomenal. That's great. So Navi, you know, obviously, and this is true, always is true, you know, Duskfall is not original, right? It was based on ideas, based on feels and looks, and it sounds like Court of Blades is as well, as far as the world that we play this game in. But at some point, it becomes its own thing, right? And I'd be curious to know, what do you think maybe that was? So if we can't go back to the genesis of it, let's start when it stopped being you going, give me something vaguely Italian, where it started becoming, this is a world. And instead of me, and I hear writers talk about this all the time, where they stop talking, they start listening, right? When the world starts telling them what this place is, when do you feel like that happened?
I think once the broad strokes were down and I started to feel like I was in my element where I could just be kind of creative and have fun with it, because I think I approach things a little bit like, I'm not comparing myself to this person because they're a master, but I approach things like a little bit like Terry Pratchett, where I want a little bit of whimsy and fun to start appearing. So even in this super serious setting, you're going to discover that we have a faction, Soraya, who is a witch who lives under the bridge with her army of cats. And so you're going to find these kind of interesting things that are kind of laced in there, and whether or not people want to interface with the goofier parts or not, but they're there. My favorite holiday in Illyrian is the holiday of eels, where everybody celebrates the eels, you know, going to their spawning place. And we have this ridiculous law that everybody can catch as many eels as they can, as long as they do it with their hands. That's a rule. But if you're caught using nets or cheating in any way, you are publicly whipped through the streets with eels. So it's just a lot of fun stuff kind of starts sneaking in there. And I think that's when it starts to become less a dramatic, historic, romantic piece and a little bit more me.
So I'd be curious, there's a lot of flexibility in Forged games. You know, if I want to play a strict criminal thieving game of Blades, we can. If I want a spooky, creepy game of Blades, we can do it. In your mind, Navi, what is the range there? So it sounds like there's some whimsy in there, but if I ran it for three different groups, what are three different things that I might see?
So you can play a very highly political game. You can play that that game of scheming nobles and backbiting, and all you want to do is host balls and undermine everyone else. And we have a house that's perfectly geared towards that. The Lavelles. That's their hat, so to speak. But if you wanted to play, let's say something a little bit more like Robin Hood, where you want to be maybe not the best terms with all of the other noble houses, but the people like you and you're doing good for them, that's House Bastien. Like, that's your, this is shoe-in. So if you want to play a game like that, and each house kind of has its own strong flavor like that. I think that Battaglia lends itself very well to playing like the Musketeers. And if you want to play something a little bit more Blades in the Dark, like let's say you love Blades in the Dark and you want to capture that feeling, House Corbetto is kind of our house of, we call them the Majestic Tyrants. Like, they're our house of well, obviously majesty, but also like seduction and the arcane, and like they have a lot of really cool skills that lend themselves towards doing things late at night. They get bonuses if they're out after the, you know, between the hours of tryst and whist, so like midnight and 4 a.m. That's where they get their bonus. So if you want to play a little bit more Blades in the Dark in Illyrian, you can grab House Corvetto. So it has that big, big range. And if, and table culture is so important in especially in this game, because it really is the difference between, do you want to have a very social game, or, you know what, I want to play something that's a little bit more grittier and I want to play in the streets and I do want to have that more dark experience. And we do make room for that. It actually is supported even mechanically. So just choose, you know, the house that gives you those bonuses and you're shooing.
So every time I play any game, but especially Blades or other Powered by the Apocalypse games, every time I run it, it changes how I run it going forward. It changes how I do it. So I'd be interested for either of you. Can you look to some, maybe one or two instances where the playtesters, your players, changed the game?
Oh, gosh, a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's every time we took it to the table, we found a different friction point, a different thing that sang. Mm-hmm. So our first playtest was very much in the pocket of you know, these scheming nobles, and it kind of went around and around and around, and it didn't go anywhere fast. But when we refined a couple more times, we ended up being more into Blades in the Dark. Mm-hmm. I think that every time we iterated, we ended up, I hesitate to use the word fixing, but at least refining exactly what our game was about. That's how the big GM turn where the other houses make their moves came about. That's where intrigues came about. That's where the paramour system came from. That is where a lot of our advances, like our advanced moves that you get as you level up, came from, because there's, we need some way to do this, or we need a faction that we can do this with.
Right.
The Court of Blades would absolutely not be what it is if it wasn't for our amazing playtesters who patiently just like were willing to keep playing through iteration after iteration. And so much of it is just listening to them play, and then they don't know I'm doing it, but I'm over here making notes because I can tell when they're really excited about something. Okay, we need to lean into this. Yep. So playtesters really kind of guided our path. They really let us know what they wanted out of a game of social intrigue, and they let us know if they felt like a game was going too much into Blades territory.
Yep. Yep. Because you didn't want to make Blades 2.0, right?
You had a
very distinct feel, right? Which is, mm-hmm. which is not Blades in the Dark. The world that you have created is not that. And I think that's wonderful. So one of the things that I have, now that I've interviewed a lot of different people that are designers, one of the things that I hear often, not every time, is I hear often there was a big change that tends to be one of the last things that happen. And the story goes that I've heard, and like I said, not everyone has told me this is how it worked, but I've heard it enough that I'm going to throw it at you, is, you know, we're going in and like last minute we said, you know what, let's just throw this out, or let's just throw this in. And it was like, oh my God, like it all clicks now, like it all came together. And there was an itch that they couldn't scratch, and they made this last change. Did that happen to you guys with this game?
It was Intrigue.
Yeah.
So explain to me Intrigue.
Okay, so Intrigue, in Blades in the Dark, you have the ability to establish a long-term clock. where you are, you know, pursuing an objective. It could be crafting something or discovering an ancient ritual or really anything that kind of doesn't fit with the established rules of the game. Intrigues are basically that, but they're risky. Because what they're doing is, so to explain this, I'm going to have to explain a different system, and I'm apologizing because you're going to have to come with me.
We're here.
With that? Okay.
So the if it's GM boring turn, shit, I'll just edit it all.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So you don't have to worry about that.
Easy day. I love
pre-recorded format. This is great.
No, go ahead. So let's talk about the other system that leads us to there.
So the GM turn is where you kind of set up Ilrian. You have basically almost like artificial intelligence houses. You've got roll charts to define what their objectives are. Every social season, they roll some dice and you see how the city changes.
Nice.
So you've got a long-term clock or a long-term downtime action that you can use to discover what they're doing and get in the way of it. You can, you know, go on errands to, you know, Corbetto is trying to negotiate a trade deal with these people, and we're going to go and torpedo that so they can't make any progress, get more powerful.
Right.
Intrigues are where you do this proactively. So if there's a portion of the city that you're trying to take control of, if there's a certain rival who is getting in the way, if you are looking to, you know, expand your territory and take assets and things like that, do this grand skullduggery, you have a conversation, much like talking through a ritual with your GM. You have a question and answer phase where you are defining what you're trying to do, what you're risking by doing it, how long it's going to take, whose help you need, what happens if you're discovered, and what collateral damage may result.
So cool.
So with this back and forth between GM and player, you establish two racing clocks.
Oh,
so
okay.
You're trying to fill your clock before you are discovered. Every time you do one of these intrigue downtime actions, you're ticking your clock, but you're not always in a controlled position. It's not just a fortune roll. These are actions that are taken in the fiction that you are opening yourself up to consequences. And as these tick up, it could be that the worst happens, you're discovered, you lose favor and face. Overall, it could be really bad for you. Or you might enact these grand sweeping narrative changes in Ilrian in a very, you know, prescriptive and descriptive way.
So the last question before we move on is, and this is something I wasn't able to figure out. So as one of my top questions I wanted to ask you. So instead of crews, we have houses, right? And then factions are houses as well. And we play as for a house. In play, how often do the higher ups in the house come into play? So if you know, me and my buddies are running a game and we're playing as these, you know, high-end operatives for a house, how often in your experience has other members higher up in the house come into play?
I think a lot of it has to do with the desires of the players, because we've had some groups where they really didn't have that much interest. So they would get their dossier from their, you know, kind of handler, and they would go about their business, and they had very little interaction with the house, and they liked it that way. But we've also had players are like, no, we want to be very involved in the house, so we spend a lot more time fleshing out those NPCs. So it's a little personal to each table.
Yeah.
But every contact list, everyone has a member of the house. So you do have a job to flesh out at least one member of the house and make sure that there is someone over you that you are invested in and interested in.
Got it. Okay.
There's a stretch goal that's on the table right now as well. If we manage to hit our pie in the sky number, we're going to be adding on Court of Thrones, which is where you are playing between these social seasons, the movers and shakers in the house. So we would like, we're going to do that one way or the other. It's just whether or not it's shipped
whether
with the
it's
game.
Now or later. And right. And from what I read about that when I was reading about the stretch goal, that's when you're going to get into kind of the secondary mini game like we saw in Band of Blaze. Does that sound accurate?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. That's really cool. That's really cool.
I'm really excited about it.
So that's actually a perfect transition, because what I want to talk about after this break is I want to talk about kind of the business and the logistics of actually creating a game and putting it out there. And if you haven't picked up on it, they've got a Kickstarter going right now, and we'll find out how that happened. We'll be right back.
There are so many online retailers. It can be hard to find one that is trustworthy, has great prices, along with some reliable customer service. On the third floor, we love ordering our gaming goodies from Gadzooks Gaming. Their selection of terrain, miniatures, dice, custom decor, and conversion bits are curated for gamers by gamers. You'll find they have what you need and what you didn't know you needed to take your gaming fun to the next level. If you mention Third Floor Wars in the cart notes of your order, you'll also get a free gift. And you'll help support the podcast. Check out GadzooksGaming.com and mention Third Floor Wars on checkout to get that free gift. Like I said, I found them originally on Twitter before the Kickstarter came out. You guys are very clever, kind of throwing out little bit of tidbits of what this game is. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. This is interesting. Every time I read it, I was like nodding my head. And then the Kickstarter drops. And I think it was 4 minutes later, I went and backed it, right? It definitely sold me. It's the first Forged in the Dark game that I've backed, which is it's not the first one that I've seen. And I'm not saying, it sounds like I'm bashing other Forged in the Dark games. There's some really, really good ones out there. The Scum and Villainy one is really, really good. The Band of Blades. Yeah, it's phenomenal. But they just weren't different enough for me. Whereas this had its own feel. So you guys have a game. You've made the decision, you know, this needs to get out to more people. When did you go Kickstarter versus itch versus, you know, when did you guys make that choice?
You handle it.
That's actually a really tough question because I don't really even know where we decided to kind of make that choice. As the project got larger and larger and kind of took on a life of its own. We knew that we had just at some point we're like, we have an entire book on our hands. Like, yeah. I think I'm a bad person. I neglected to put the approximate page count on the Kickstarter, but this is a 350 page beast.
Before art.
Yeah, before art.
Wow.
So it has a lot going because you know, turning the GM's turn into the AI and all of that takes a little doing and a lot of charts.
Sure.
So there's some good stuff in there. We promise we don't overcomplicate it too much, but it's got a lot going on. So at some point we're like, we have an entire book on our hands, and what are we going to do with this thing? We had kicked around ideas. Should we release it? And I think that we had decided we would be doing it sort of an injustice to not see it through and have it, you know, edited by a professional editor that really knows what they're doing.
Yep. God bless you for doing that, by the way.
Right.
And that's, if we had just thrown it on Itch, it would have just been like our, you know,
yep,
project that's pretty good, but it won't be the thing that we're hoping it to be once it goes through that beautiful editing phase. So, and then of course, you know, you start looking at the cost for editing and we're like, all right, look, that's a lot of money. So we're going to have to figure something out. I think that's probably where the Kickstarter was born. It really is. It really truly is a crowdfunded project. Like, people have told us that they want it and they're making it happen. It would not exist without you guys.
Well, and you call out something that's really important, which is everybody sees something like this, especially with an RPG, and goes, "Oh, that's just printing costs." That's what those are. It's like, no, unless the Drakes are drawing those pictures, then they're gonna have to hire somebody. Unless they're gonna edit them, and thank God you're not editing your own book, you're hiring somebody who knows how to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that stuff is expensive. So I guess now, where does the accounting part come? When do you sit down and you say, okay, you know, here's our cost. This is mm-hmm. what we want it to look like. And how do you back into that and figure out, you know, how much, what your initial goal is going to be?
So it was a lot of legwork. And I'm so glad that we have a really great Twitter group. Like, the Twitter community around the TTRPG scene is so supportive and so amazing.
Yep.
Anytime I have a question of any kind, I just put it out there, and the feedback that I get from everybody is amazing. So a lot of it was just kind of, you know, beating the pavement, like, you guys, I need help with this. And they give me like a list of artists. And I spend a week looking through artists and reaching out and saying, hey, this is my project. You know, what are your typical fees and things like that? And so I actually went to everybody individually that I was interested in working with. And again, amazing community, because these artists and editors and whatnot, like, they're like, oh, you might get funding? No, they never treated me that way at all. They were like, oh, that's amazing. Like, I totally would work with you. Here's what it's gonna cost. And they gave me the recipe that I needed to figure out how much this project was gonna run.
She's always been our number cruncher. We have a we have a home business as well, and she's my accountant. Like.
That's, you know, I would not have guessed that because of how we talked about how you guys split up the game design piece of it. So you figure out, okay, we're going to do this Kickstarter. We've got an idea of our costs. So in order for us to be able to pull the trigger on this, this is the levels it's going to be. How do you come up with tiers? How do you figure out pledge levels and things and go through that process?
I think part of it was, we wanted to stay within line with the other games in the system, not just because it would be, again, a disservice to the entire community if we started dropping prices and lowballing everyone. Because this might be our first project, and you know, we're kind of green, but other people, this is their bread and butter. And if we go in and we're just destroying the pricing, that's not okay. But we also, again, because this community is so great, we also do have I guess sometimes they like to call it the hardship tier. We call it the tier with an assist. So you can grab the PDF at half cost if you, and it's honor system. If you feel like you're having financial struggles, go ahead and grab it and everybody's happy. But so we started with just looking and seeing where the lines currently were. And we kind of tried to stay in that same pocket. And the reason why we're at $35 for the hardcover, even though we're this giant, you know, Band of Blades sized monsters, because we do plan to have the final retail price be in line with that, like you'd expect. So it will be $40 upon release. But right now for Kickstarter, this is really about getting a good price to people for believing in the project. That price will go up and fall into line with the other ones. But that's really how we did it. We made sure that we weren't hurting anyone else with our pricing.
I am amazed. I feel like us role players are like abused children in some ways, because, like, think about for $40, let alone $35, what you're getting. And, like, I'm amazed because I came from miniatures, right? So I played miniature games where, like, I'll pay $35, $40, right, for a model, right? One freaking model. And the amount of value we get, and it's in some ways it's a shame a little bit. And I'm not saying that I hope role playing games get more expensive, but I think they could. I think it's great that you guys had an awareness of that. On the high end, obviously, it's much easier, which is you don't want to price yourself out. But I love the fact that you said, you know what, we're going to put a floor on this, too. And that is that I think that's very supportive of the community itself, which I really like. So you guys were in the midst of the Kickstarter real quick, because I didn't look this morning. Where are we right now?
Ooh, last time we were sneaking up on $35,000, and even more amazing than that, over 1,000 backers. I cannot believe it.
1,005 at last check.
And we've got, what day do we close?
We close on the 21st of May.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so we've got a good week or so since this is coming out for people to go to look at that. And you go through, you get your surge at the beginning. You guys are kind of in the wallows right now where, you know, you're going to grow and grow. And then usually, you know, you see the spurt at the end. You guys have said this on Twitter, but people listening to us right now, man, I know this. You guys didn't expect this.
No.
our goal was to cover editing costs, and art was really going to be a bonus. So we were like $7,500, fingers crossed, maybe people really want to see this edited. And then it just grew so much larger than we could have expected.
How soon after dropping the Kickstarter did you suddenly go, oh, geez, like this is going to be wow.
Yeah, I woke up that morning. And I rolled over and I checked Twitter because I knew it was the day, and I saw that somebody had tweeted waiting for Navi and Drake to wake up and push the go button, and then John Harper right under it, same. I'm like, okay, I better get up. So I got up and I pushed the button and I went to go, you know, change tabs to go back to Twitter. But before I could, we were at 500.
Isn't that amazing?
I had no idea what to do with myself.
Yeah.
But I think that first hour, I got my cup of coffee. I had to go run an errand with my father-in-law. And while I was out, I've just checked it, and I'm like, we might actually like hit half our goal today.
And I was still asleep at this time, so I'm not a morning person. And I even for my favorite people in the world, there was no alarm set. Like I was sleeping, and he wakes me up, and he's like, so we're halfway funded. I'm like, what time is it? Where am I?
Like
we were halfway to goal and I was just getting out of bed. I had to like rush and like try and get my tweets out. It was great.
So what do you think it is? So now that you guys are fully funded and stuff like that, like I said, I found you via Twitter. So the Twitter game, whether it was calculated or not, your Twitter game was excellent because you guys were very generous about it. You guys were teasing a little bit about it. You kind of leaked things out a little bit. So, I mean, I drank your Kool-Aid. You did a good job with that. And like I said, I don't know how calculated it was, but it worked.
It is delicious.
What do you why do you think this you've had such a big success right out of the gate? And we're not even done yet. Have you had a chance to look back yet and start to figure out what may have happened?
I think the biggest feedback that we've gotten that's made us just so ecstatic is, I think you've touched on it yourself a little bit earlier. So many people haven't seen a game in this style for this system. This brings you out of the grim dark that the system likes to cling to.
Yep.
And a lot of, and of course, everybody who's into historical drama and whatnot, you wouldn't believe how many people have reached out to me like, oh, they a home for my fops. They're so excited about the idea of being able to put on their powdered wigs, and that to me is amazing.
Yeah.
Joy.
Yeah, but you know, but you think about it though, like Bridgerton is real big right now. So I thought maybe that, you know, I could see where that has hit board. But yeah, that's what it was for me. Was the uniqueness of the setting is what got my interest. And then as I started grokking some of the mechanics and reading that, I was like, ooh, this is good. This is interesting. What kind of advice did you guys get about Kickstarter from other people in the community?
We reached out to a lot of people, mostly for like sanity checks. Like, yeah. Are we crazy here? Like, do you think that this is well put together? Like, should I not do the funny accent? Like, what do you think here? And just getting people to look it over, again, just sort of like how we did for playtesting, we got a lot of really positive feedback. Like, this looks way more professional than your first Kickstarter. You look like you've got a real, you know, tight theme. You're delivering a good hook. Like, this is something that I want on my shelf. And we're like, okay, what kind of feedback? More tiers, okay? What kind of stuff do you want on those tiers? Play the game with me. Oh, okay, I can do that. Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of that kind of like, that kind of feedback where it kind of drove how we set up our backer tiers and how we set up our stretch goals. So that was really helpful for us.
Yep.
What cautionary tales have you been told, things that you're watching out for?
So I actually, one of my my Twitter friends, I guess follow friend, whatever you call them.
Mutuals.
One of my mutuals had done a very, very big Kickstarter. He was a video game designer, so you know the budgets on those are much bigger. And it funded really well. It did $200,000, but in the video game world, that goes fast. And so he actually had ended up not being able to be produced because they ran out of funds. It just didn't work out. So he was giving me his tale of woe, and he's like, all right, just do me this favor and make sure that whatever you think it's going to cost, I want you to times it by 3.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so I took that into account. When we set our goal of 7,500, it was taking into account that, okay, we might have to come out of pocket a couple $1,000s, but we can swing that. We can't swing the whole thing, but we can swing part of it because we really wanted this to happen.
Yep.
And obviously the community was like, no, thank you. But so we did get some of that feedback to be very careful about not under, not overselling ourselves or overextending ourselves. And Yeah, I think that was one of the most invaluable conversations that I had, because it was a really real conversation. They were very open with what had happened, and it's a vulnerable thing to have to talk about.
Well, as somebody who's backed, I think, a total of 5 Kickstarters and were never delivered on, it was always that same story. It was always that same story. How did you come up with, or how did you back into your delivery date?
That was actually a conversation with Sean Nittner. Mm-hmm. We asked what Evil Hat's delivery timelines, what their backer timelines are, and we decided that people would be less upset if we delivered early. We were originally saying that December of 2021, we were going to have the book done, and we can probably hit that timeline. But we wanted to make sure that there was plenty of room for, I mean, we've got the possibility of extra submissions for like the community zine. We've got God willing, if we can get Court of Thrones backed, we're going to have to play test and refine that particular set of mechanics.
That one might not come out at the same time. That's a big deal.
It's a whole other game.
It's like a mini game you got to kind of tack on. But there's also the matter of international shipping, because international shipping is so very tricky for if you're starting out and you don't have connections and distributors and you don't know how many copies you're going to sell. And it's really, you hate to say it, but you're like, if I send you a book from here and you're in the UK, that book is going to cost more than the book to ship it to you. It's $40 to ship a book to the UK. Yep. And I wish I could do something about that, but I really can't. But if we, now that we see how many people from overseas are backing, we're like, we might actually be able to get them better prices on a non-POD with a distributor. But that takes time, because you have to send it like freight. You have to send it like they overboat, so to for the shipping costs, and then it gets to the distributor, and the distributor has to take it out and send it out to everybody. So that'll really extend that timeline, and we just really didn't want to run into a situation where people, especially around December, where people are so worked up about the holidays. Yeah. We didn't want anybody associating it with, oh, I'm going to get this in time for Christmas. Ooh. That's scary. So
had I saw December 21 on there, it wouldn't have stopped me from backing it, but I really would have gone, So it was good advice. It was good advice. I have now, because I have a huge Kickstarter problem. It's one of the things that I look to. I look to it, and if it's too soon, it stopped me from backing before, because and this sounds terrible, but it's just like, well, they're amateurs, and this proves that they're amateurs and they don't know what they're doing. So my chances of getting this are much less. So that was excellent advice. So now the big question, which is, if I were to break into the Drake's house tonight.
Oh, no.
You guys are out to dinner. You're not there. and to look at what condition is Court of Blades in today? What's left?
I'll feel that. Okay. I'll feel that. So it's text complete. It's in the midst of being edited for tone, just cohesiveness of tone. We are completely playable. Everything that is going to be in Court of Blades is in Court of Blades as of today.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
But it's missing all of its gorgeous art that we're about to commission. It's missing its map. It is basically the game that we have had so much fun with our weekly group for about the past year and a half, with a couple of extra cool goodies that have been, you know, added on from other groups. But yes, it's a playable product. It will be deliverable by the end of the Kickstarter.
So in your mind, the design of the game is done, right? Your pencil's down at this point. So now it's a matter of producing it. Does that sound accurate?
Only the drudgery remains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the boring shit. That's funny. So obviously we're gonna link to the Kickstarter here in the show notes, and I'll be blasting it on Twitter when this comes out as well. If people want more Drakes, where else can they go?
Well, you can yell at me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. That's pretty effective. I'm at Drake and Dice.
and I am at Navi Musing. And that is exactly what I do on that particular Twitter feed. I'm a little bit of a cheerleader for the TTRPG community, so you're going to get a lot of other people's games and things mixed in, and sometimes just random stuff that I think is kind of fun. I'm the junk food of the community. So if you're coming to me for like wholesome, like really good detailed, that's not what I'm about. So go to him for that, because he's really great at like really getting into the nitty gritty of like TTRPGs. Meanwhile, I'm like, check out this funny meme.
Yeah, I'm your vegetables. I'm all the roughage.
She's the buttered popcorn.
Exactly. She's buttered popcorn, and I'm like broccoli.
Well, I'm enjoying both Twitter feeds, so we'll link to those as well. I'm also going to link to your itch, because there's some really neat stuff on there. Like I said, and if listeners play Blades, just go spend the 5, 10, 15 bucks, whatever you want to give to them. Just go get them. Trust me, their Blade supplements are excellent. I can't thank enough. I mean, you guys are in the middle of it all right now, and you made time for me and my listeners. So I just can't thank you enough.
We appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, this was really great.
I'm glad. For those of you fools that sat around all the way to the end listening, I appreciate you sticking around. Take care.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch so you don't miss the avalanche of content we create. Links are in the show notes. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest in gaming apparel and gear. There you'll also find the latest information for the U.S. FOE Tour. Find out where you rank in your conference or even in the entire United States. Get those models built, painted, and ready so we can see you at the next U.S. FOE Tour Masters event. Please take a moment to write a review of this pod on your favorite platform. Rating and reviewing helps us find more listeners almost as cool as you are. Be sure to share this feed with all of your friends who love tabletop gaming. Thanks for listening.
All right. I'm gonna grab some water real fast.
Take your time.
Unacceptable. Professionalism.
So I'm super happy.
Giant jug.
I'm super happy because we covered a lot of the development now, so I think we can transition right into what I think a lot of people are gonna find interesting, which is, you know, how you guys have pulled off what the hell you pulled off.
Well, if you figure it out before we do.
I have been living through your reactions because I have been sitting here. Oh, shit. I got to start recording. Hold on. Let me bring this back. this is going to be good. I was going to pay you a compliment. So. Go ahead. Went all over the place at the end there. Great job, guys. Perfect. Exactly what I love is just shooting the shit, which makes me really happy. Thank you.
Awesome.
All right. Trying to think of how I want to bring us back. Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over. And you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast too while you're at it. On whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.